Welcome, friends, to the Generations Broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson, your host. Also, Dave Buhner here in studio in my basement. During the demise of Western civilization, the breakdown of faith, family, and freedom, just a couple of dads trying to put things together and looking for the light switch on the side of the wall and assuming that God knows what he's talking about in the Word, so that if we apply the book of Proverbs, say, to every area of life, then that could be a really good thing for our kids and grandkids. That's the basic presupposition that works in our thinking on the program.
So we could say that, like a bumper sticker, civilization, some assembly required. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Exactly. And, you know, Dave, I don't know if we can salvage all of Western civilization. And, of course, there's a tension there, too. But we can do what we can with our families, our churches, and communities. And that's what we're doing, friends. Yet here's a positive article from the Wall Street Journal, The Coming Tech-Led Boom. This guy talks about all the recessions, 19 recessions since 1912. So a lot of recessions. So that's what happens. You know, hey, recessions happen. But we are 700% wealthier than we were 100 years ago. 100 years ago, apparently, we were, if the average person is making, say, $50,000, average family taking home $50,000, average family would have been subsisting at about $7,000 to $8,000 a year some 100 years ago. So what he's saying is that we're going to be, if the average family is at 50,000 this year, in another 40, 50 years from now, he says in this, because of the tech-led boom, the average family is going to be living a lifestyle at about $350,000 per year because it's going to improve in the next generation or two. And he's very excited about technology. Technology saving us, of course. Remember the Newsweek article, or was it Time Magazine article, came out about a year ago, Dave, and it said that man would be immortal by 2040?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And then I was a little bummed out because I wasn't sure I was going to live that long.
Yeah, well, yeah, immortality isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Okay, well, the technology is supposed to save us, friends. That's the belief on the part of these guys that write for the Wall Street Journal. And you know, there's a lot of hope out there. Technology has done a lot of good. No question about it. Agriculture has improved dramatically. Manufacturing has enjoyed high-volume processes, and I was involved in that for a number of years as a mechanical engineer in process engineering, manufacturing engineering, and quality engineering. And yeah, we were pumping out hundreds of thousands of widgets for the automotive industry and for the computer industry back in the 1990s, and I worked hard to get those things out, and technology was helping. It was cranking, man, and it was getting materials out, electronic gadgets and other things, cars, computers and such that the average person could own these things, and of course nobody could own them back in the 1920s or 1910s, but they sure can now thanks to the advances in technology. No question, technology has done a lot. But during the same time that technology was advancing, friends, we had a lot of other issues taking place as well. Hey, you had the increase of debt. Now, granted, the baby boom generation allowed for a huge expansion of economies. Why? Because the average baby boomer was having four kids per family. And the baby boom generation added a tremendous, tremendous workforce that was fairly well educated and had the character of previous generations, hadn't completely jettisoned it at that point, but it was in the process of jettisoning it. And so, Dave, here we are in the 2012s, and you have to admit that we have far less character today than previous generations. I mean, we know that. That's a data point. Our families are seven times weaker than previous generations. We're in far more debt. We're in about 7 to 10 times more debt, family debt, household debt, than we were at the turn of the 20th century. And, of course, government is up to, what, $16 trillion in debt? And you just told me $120 trillion in unfunded liabilities on the part of the federal government, which means we're in a lot more trouble than we were in 1920, 1930.
Yeah, there's not an iPhone app that's going to solve a $140 trillion debt problem. We know that that's not going to be – there's an app. There's not an app for that.
Yeah.
You know, to quote them, there's no app for that one.
Yeah, there's no app for that one. Well, yeah.
And what's more is when we were having the baby boom, we understood – and we can look back and understand this clearly now. Contrary to what Malthus said, people are an asset to an economy.
Oh, yes.
When you're having children, your economy grows because you have more labor. You have a larger labor force. You have more ideas. You have more innovations because you have more minds thinking about it. You have more people saying, huh, how can I make a mark in the marketplace? What product, what service can I come up with? Well, we now live in a shrinking a stagnant, at least, population where people aren't having children. And the workforce then has been one that's largely imported. At some point, we're going to run out of third world countries to import for cheap labor.
Yeah. And Dave, I think agriculture could go either way. Agriculture could go either way. It's hard to know where agriculture is going. On the one hand, it appears that some forms of agriculture will deplete the soil. Some forms of agriculture will destroy the sorts of agriculture that that God intended for us to use. And Dave, I'm guessing an existentialistic, myopic approach to agriculture is going to kill us if we're not careful. Unfortunately, our economies are largely built upon debt, and that debt is going to destroy our economies. But could a myopic existentialistic form of philosophy affect the way that we use pesticides, the way that we develop seeds? The way that we develop seeds that have no real ability to develop themselves in the next generation, could the developments of agriculture negatively affect the future of this country? I think it could. On the other hand, Dave, we could potentially do some good things in the area of agriculture as well. Hydroponic farming would be one area where we could improve, but I'm not sure that's going to improve the efficiency of farming.
Well, it depends on what you mean by efficiency. If we're talking about the number of bushels of corn per man hour, I think we can increase productivity, especially when you factor in things like shipping time. You know, the amount of energy it takes to move a bushel of corn from Iowa to Miami, Florida, that might be improved also. But also, there's another kind of efficiency when we talk about agriculture, and that's the yield per acre. Well, I'm not sure we're going to get that much more yield per acre. We might get another 10-15%.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot of acres.
Not 700%.
But there's a lot of acres
that
aren't growing anything.
That's true, too.
And I think that's where agriculture might be able make its biggest dent.
Right.
Most of Wyoming, eastern Colorado, western Nebraska. I mean, have you been to these places?
Yeah.
All of Nevada, practically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's nothing growing there. There's no crops growing. If we could utilize that land, and the biggest resource on that land, by the way, is the sun.
Yeah.
And so we're getting energy from the sun, and the energy is converted by the plants into food and so forth. Mm-hmm. Can we come up with drought-resistant corns and wheats? Maybe, perhaps, that might be a big boost in the land efficiency. Yeah. What's more, if you have the sun, then you have the energy source, you can do more artificial-type food raising, hydroponics, aquaponics, et cetera. So there's room if men are taking dominion, but only if there's a heart and a desire and a character to do it.
And Dave, I think we ought to be careful not to hang all of our hopes on technology. We still need wisdom. We still need hard work. We still need people using brains and hands and feet to do the work. We need the character of the nation to be something better than it is right now. We need to be out of our $120 trillion of unfunded liability debt, as far as Washington is concerned. I think, Dave, we need better families, stronger families. If these economies are going to survive, we really need the character that can only be formed in the development of strong families, and we don't have that in this nation anymore. No. Hey, we got 7 times more kids born without fathers since 1960. That's a big problem, not being configured into this these numbers that Wall Street Journal put out in a recent article, the coming tech-led boom. 3 breakthroughs are poised to transform this century as much as telephones and electricity did the last. Well, Dave, I hate to break the bad news, but just developing more technology that provides a little more access to electronic gadgets for the average person is not going to do a lot of good. In fact, if anything, Dave, a lot of the electronic gadgets actually have contributed to the breakdown of character and hard work on the part of our young men. They are less motivated to engage in productive labor because of all of this electronic gadgetry.
Let's say that electronic gadgetry certainly provides a compelling distraction from productive work. You can Facebook all day long. You can play Asphalt Adrenaline on your computer, on your iPad, on your phone. You don't get to escape that very compelling, and it's very compelling entertainment. But it is entertainment. It's not labor. So while technology is enabled a leveraging of labor, that you can do so many more things in terms of communication, and certain things can be done without human interference. We can do transfers of money all around the place, buying and selling through computer things that actually makes more efficient labor source. It also is enabled you to screw off a whole lot more at work.
Yeah. Folks, you got a lot of things happening in our society today. We're betting on the fact that character matters. We're betting on the fact that morality matters, that God's principles relating to debt and economics matter. We're betting on a lot of things. The other side bets on technology. They think that technology will save them. Not going to happen, friends. Not going to happen. Here's a article from the Great Britain. This is Christian.com.uk. People have less integrity, and it's harming society. Apparently, this professor, Paul Whiteley, did a study. This is the Essex Center for the Study of Integrity. Did a study of 2,000 adults in Great Britain, and he found that people have less integrity. It's harming society. British people have significantly less integrity than 10 years ago. Apparently, less civic-mindedness. There's more adultery, lying, underage sex, all becoming acceptable. He blames the bad example set by footballers cheating on their wives, the phone hacking scandal, dodgy financial dealing. He says the implications could be profound for society. The findings show that people with high levels of integrity tend to have a strong sense of civil duty. He commented if social capital is low and people are suspicious, don't work together. These communities have worse health, worse educational performance. They are less happy. They're less economically developed and entrepreneurial. It really does have a profound effect. Interesting stuff from the UK. The breakdown of the character of the Britons, very, very significant. Here's another study. Britons are more dishonest than 10 years ago. A lot of other studies in Britain are discovering that the integrity of the nation is breaking down. Our bet is that you break down the integrity of the nation, you're going to break down the economy of the nation. That's just the way it goes, friends. Hey, the strongest economic nations around the world, those with the strongest middle class, are by and large nations that have been instructed in the Word of God. Protestant nations, the strongest nations you're going to find are nations where the average family has access to the Word of God, and there's been a fair amount of family discipleship and reading of the Bible and application of the Bible in those homes. 7 out of the 10 most wealthy nations, as far as the median income is concerned, are Protestant nations. I think that's really, really important. 7 out of 10 of the highest median income nations in the world. That is not the nation where you've got a couple of rich people in Saudi Arabia that consume 80% of the GNI. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about nations where the strength of economy has made its way into the grassroots of the nation, and it's upheld an entire economy of hundreds of millions of people over 200 years. Friends, they've been Protestant nations where the Word of God has been taught, where the Bible, sola scriptura, is important, and it's been worked into the fiber of the people, largely because family worship was significant for hundreds of years until perhaps the last 50 to 60 years, where we've seen a significant breakdown of generational continuity, where people are walking away from the faith wholesale. That's happening in this country right now, with 88% of Christian kids raised in Christian homes walking away from the faith as they walk away from the home. We're not talking about that. We're talking about nations that have those roots, and they've had some really significant economic blessings over a long period of time. And it happened largely because church attendance was pretty decent. In fact, Dave, I just read an article about Britain. In some areas of London, church attendance is 0.8%. 0.8% in London. Okay, that's what's happening. That's what the secularists are doing. That's what Richard Dawkins, that's what the universities, Oxford, Cambridge, that's what the universities have been focused on. That's why 94% of American university professors believe that prayer is something that ought never, never, never to belong in school. Okay, the secularization of a country, England, America, Canada, etc., will lead to the breakdown of the integrity of the nation. That's just what happens. That's why you have nations where 50% of the kids are born without fathers, up from 6-7% in 1960. We're seeing the breakdown of families, the breakdown of integrity, the breakdown of economies. Why? Because we've abandoned the roots of our nations. That's why. And we'll be back in just a moment. My name is Kevin Swanson, Dave Buhner, another dad in studio with me.
Are you tired of running the corporate rat race? Are you struggling to make healthcare choices? Are you looking for a better job? Maybe even a job that your entire family can be involved in? Do you want to take your family to the next level? The 2012 Family Economics Conference is designed to help family with the vision and resources to make practical steps to build their family's economy. From practical household budgeting and finance to starting your own business, to making wise decisions about college and career preparation, the Family Economics Conference has something for everyone. There will even be a special Proverbs 31 track for the ladies' role in the family economy. For more information, or to sign up online, go to www.FamilyEconomics2012.com. That's FamilyEconomics2012.com.
And we are back on the Generations broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, homeschool father of five here. Dave also in studio with me. And Dave, here's another interesting article from the Wall Street Journal. As long as we're hitting up the Wall Street Journal today, my dad sent this article to me a couple days ago, What's Wrong with the Teenage Mind? And I'm going to go to the end in just a moment. But before we do that, apparently there's some things wrong with the teenage mind. Children are reaching puberty earlier and adulthood later. The result is a lot of teenage weirdness, according to Allison Gopnik in this article from the Wall Street Journal. She says adolescents have always been troubled. But for reasons that are somewhat mysterious, puberty is now kicking in at earlier and earlier ages. A leading theory points to changes in energy balances as children eat more and move less. I guess that's a no-brainer. She says, we've always had troubles with teenagers, but I don't necessarily agree with that, Dave. I mean, I think this teenage thing is a relatively new phenomenon. There's an excellent little book put together by some sociologist. Can't remember the guy's name, but it's called Teenage. And he just traces the whole rise of adolescence and the teenage phenomena, and it really was a fairly new phenomenon in the history of the world. It came about in the early 1800s. I mean, it started in the 1820s, 1830s with the Industrial Revolution. It started on the streets when kids were abandoned by their parents who were off to work. And, of course, there were no Sunday schools, and there were no public schools at the time. And so it started with kids that were abandoned by their parents and weren't being raised by anybody in the early part of the 19th century. They formed gangs and such. And then out of that eventually came a mainstream movement. So it was sort of a little bit of a movement of young rebels, and there were sort of a gangs here and gangs there all the way into the 1920s, 1930s. After World War II, around 1946, it all came to a head, and the teenage movement really kicked in, and adolescence now became mainstream in America. Now, it doesn't have to be, but it's a social movement that is a derivative of the abandonment of fathers of the home. Fathers have left the home, mothers left the home, and eventually, in order to create a massive system of adolescence, you're going to have all the teenagers flocking into these big junior highs and high schools, and that creates a youth culture, a teen culture. And of course, what adds to that is all the music and the rest of the culture that encourages adolescence and perpetual adolescence. And the hearts of the fathers and the mothers are pretty much severed from the children. And Dave, you know, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, these kids were raised by parents. I mean, even if they did have a little opportunity to go to work or to school, they would be with their parents all night long in the same room with a little lantern flickering and a little fire there in the corner going to keep everybody warm for a couple, 2-3 hours before everybody went to bed. They didn't have entertainment. They didn't have their own TV sets. They didn't have their own iPods. They didn't have their own music. They danced around the living room with Pa as he played his violin. I mean, that's what Laura Ingalls Wilder was doing in those books. That happened for 5,890 years until the last 100 years, which has been a radical, radical, radical change in social structures. And Dave, I think it is beginning to yield its fruits, and they're stinking to high heaven. And people are beginning to notice this. When you see 70% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970, according to Newsweek magazine, you know that you have a significant problem on your hands. What in the world are future economies going to do when the 30-somethings are playing computer games and the baby boom generation is playing golf? You know the economies aren't going to sustain that.
Kevin, put another way, the demographic of adolescents or teenagers became a subculture because of social engineering. You could not have it when the children were in the home, going through years in which their bodies are going through changes, puberty, in which young men are trying to strive to become real men who can stand on their own and have a family. Young girls are making that transition from girlhood to womanhood. It used to happen within the context of home and church. But once you have a centralized social engineering structure, i.e. public schools, then then you condense all of these children together in this one particular demographic, and you artificially create a subculture, and that's the teen culture that we have today. Now, that subculture wants to inhibit maturity because you bring a lot of fools together. What happens in junior high? Well, all the kids act in a very foolish way. And you know how it is. Well, maybe you didn't. You didn't go to public school.
Things are out of control these days, Dave. I mean, there's this cinnamon challenge thing. Have you heard of this?
I was reading about this morning. Yeah. Who knew that cinnamon was so bad for you?
Yeah.
Actually, in New Haven, Connecticut, there's a principal whose job's on the line because the principal saw a kid with some cinnamon in the lunchroom and didn't automatically, you know, call the school lockdown and bring everyone in because apparently these kids saw a YouTube video, and I guess it's a rage. It's a fad right now where kids try and take a teaspoon or a tablespoon, a spoonful of finely ground cinnamon.
Right.
You know, we put on cinnamon rolls and so forth.
Right.
But apparently it has some effects because of its fine powder and your saliva can't pack it down that it causes. It gets into the lungs and caused an aspiration and a coughing fits. And of course, you know, it's never good to force yourself to cough and hack and so forth. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so kids are acting like fools. Now, if you knew that this was going to be dangerous, would you have a spoonful of cinnamon to, you know, prove that you're a fool?
Pretty sad.
Well, this is what happens in junior high.
And then, of course, now you have all the sexting going on with the phones and all that.
The faculty.
That was the kind of stuff that Laura Ingalls Wilder and Almanza Wilder, they didn't do. I mean, granted, they had your typical bullies and you had some of that going on. But you know what? You didn't have the kind of things you have today. You certainly didn't have 42% of kids born without fathers back in the 1800s. Why? Because you had fathers and mothers. They raised their kids. And you know what? Occasionally, Almanzo did go to school. There's no question. We know that. We know that some kids actually went to school from time to time when they were not farming. Now, when harvest time came, he'd take off a month or two, and he would work with his dad. And then he'd go back to school for a few weeks if he had a few weeks off, a little bit more time. But there wasn't a compulsory attendance law. There wasn't anything that forced that boy in. The parents had the right to make decisions, whether they wanted their kids studying now or in another 6 months or another 2 to 3 years. Parents had the rights to make those decisions. Principle of individuality and liberty really ran very strongly in family life over about 5,900 years of world history until the last 100 years. It's just been in the last 100 years where we begin to see the breakdown of relationships, the rise of autism, the breakdown of families integrated into the experience of a child's life. Because guess what? Kids need their moms and dads. According to the Bible, that's how they're taught. That's how they're raised. That's how they learn knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, according to the book of Proverbs. It's fathers and mothers that do the teaching in the book of Proverbs. I understand Plato doesn't agree with Proverbs, but that's because Plato's wrong. Plato's wrong.
Kevin, when Laura Ingalls Wilder is in a school and there's a bully, she goes home and she talks to her mom and dad. Yeah. Mom, dad, there's a bully. How do I respond to bullies? Now, that's not what's happening now. Now kids see someone, you know, taking a spoonful of sugar, or I'm sorry, of cinnamon. A spoonful of sugar would help the medicine go down. But they're taking spoonfuls of sugar in order to create coughing fits and show that they can over, you know, they're brave enough to have coughing fits. They don't go home and say, Mom, Dad, there's some kids in school doing some really stupid things. How should I respond? Oh, I know what I should do. I should dress like they do. I should act like they do. So what you have in the public schools is the worst behaviors, the worst characters have way more influence on the population than the best.
And how do you know? How do you know that someone's been to the public schools? I mean, I know how. You look at an average 15-year-old girl and you say, well, she looks like her peers. She acts like her peers. She talks like her peers, usually in very, very, very immature forms. She looks like her peers. She has sex like her peers. She listens to the music that her peers listen to. That's how you know that somebody's been to your average public junior high or high school. That's how you know. And a lot of times you can tell at 200 yards away. Now, how do you know that someone's been homeschooled? How do you know that someone's been home discipled? Well, they're taking on their parents' culture, their parents' language, their parents' forms of communication, their parents' maturity, their parents' culture, their parents' music, their parents' dress. That's how you know someone's been homeschooled. They're discipled, not by their peers, but by their parents. I know that's very strange to some of you listening, but you got to understand that the present system of adolescence disciples itself. And don't give me this idea that the teacher really has that much influence on the lives of the kids. Okay, maybe they stuff a few facts in the minds of the kids. But when it comes to the ways that these kids are raised, the way they live, the way they think, the way they talk, the way they're going to work, their basic character is being formed by their peers. And that's crazy, Dave. That's where things go nuts.
And we have to be careful even as homeschool parents that our children are not being formed by their peers, because with the social media, with the YouTubes, I mean, this whole cinnamon thing came off of a YouTube video, apparently, with the modern communication systems, our children could be plugged into the peers while still at home. So we have to be just as careful, Kevin, that our children are being raised in the fear of God and not according to what their peers are doing.
The article is What's Wrong with the Teenage Mind from the Wall Street Journal. And friends, very interesting stuff here. She says this doesn't mean the adolescents are stupider than they used to be. In many ways, they're much smarter.
Stupider? Wall Street Journal said stupider?
Yeah, stupider, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That was a Wall Street Journal piece?
Wall Street Journal article,
wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if they went to journalism school.
I don't know.
That would be more stupid.
An ever longer protected period of immaturity and dependence of childhood that extends through college means that young humans can learn more than ever before, on and on and on. Strong evidence IQ has increased dramatically, blah, blah, blah.
IQ?
Yeah. She admits that they're smart, but there are different ways of being smart. Turns out they can't do anything in life. They might know a few things. Dave, and I would question that. I'm not sure that the average kid is that much smarter. Have you compared the writing of the average kid? I was watching a college professor grading some of his students' material on a flight out of Bismarck a couple weeks ago. And I was looking at these people's writing. I thought, this is terrible. This is like a fourth grader writing this stuff. And these are college kids, okay?
Kids are getting stupider.
Yeah, in a private college, a private Catholic college. And so I'm looking at this writing. I think this is really bad writing. Now compare that to Cotton Mather when he was 16 years old.
Yeah.
I'm serious. Just pick up Increase Mather stuff when he was 18 years old. And you can do that. You can go online, or you can go into some of the history books and find some of the things that these guys were writing when they were 16, 17, 18 years old. Guys, the kids, the average kids in the average college today, idiots.
They're stupider,
yeah.
They're stupider.
So I'm not sure I agree with this. But one thing they are saying is these kids know a lot of facts. They know where the information comes from. They're constantly taking in the big old, fact flow from the internet all the time. They're stupid facts. They're stupider facts.
Yeah.
They're not important facts. They have no relevance to life or to wisdom or to accomplishing anything and being efficient in your labors. But I mean, they're wasting time galore, and they have a lot of information, but they have no idea how to connect information. And that's because life integration would be the best way to apply knowledge. And life integration is so far away from that modern concept of education. It's ridiculous. And so most of education is a total waste of time out there, friends. I'm talking about K-12 schools. I'm talking about college classrooms. Why? Because they are way out there on an island of education where sterile people in sterile gloves and sterile masks and sterile uniforms are trying to inculcate knowledge into their brains, and they don't know how to apply this thing to real life. And that's a biblical form of epistemology that we talk about in my book, Upgrade the 10 Secrets to the Best Education for Your Child. Would encourage you to get that book if you get a chance. But what she's saying in this article, she's saying exactly what I'm saying. She says they're just not life integrated. These kids have no idea how to get into life. The kind of learning that once was routinely took place in human society is not happening anymore. For most of our history, children have started their internships when they were 7, not 27, she says. Amen to that. Instead of simply giving adolescents more and more school experiences, this lady says in the Wall Street Journal, those extra hours of after-school classes and homework, we could try to arrange more opportunities for apprenticeship. Yeah, that's what we've been saying as homeschoolers for the last 25 years, gal. She says, take your children to work. That could become a routine practice rather than a single day annual event, and college students could spend more time watching and helping scientists and scholars at work rather than just listening to their lectures. Hello, Dave, is that what the Family Economics Conference is all about? Is this the Copernican revolution in education and economics that we're trying to spawn at Wheaton College? out in Chicago, Illinois. Friends, the rest of the system is falling apart at the seams. These kids are going to be useless in society by the millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, because they have the wrong education, they're getting the wrong media, they're getting the wrong connection of information to wisdom and to life integration. We have got to radically change the way we do education. We've got to bring mentorship in. What she's saying is right. This is the Wall Street Journal.
It's kind of right. Kevin, it's kind of right. By any objective standard, children are not as doing well in academics as they used to. Whether you look at math scores are plummeting. We are third world in math. And we're not doing well in writing.
Not ready for work. They're not able to get into work. They're not able to apply themselves. They have very little direction. By the way, she says the same thing. They have some knowledge, but they have no real direction, real purpose, and they have no idea how to do life.
For learning math. They don't know the purpose for history. They don't know that the fear of God's the beginning of their knowledge. They don't know that the purpose of their life is to be worshipers, to glorify God, to find awe and magnify the name of God. They don't know that they have a dominion mandate to go out and do work. So the economics conference, we're saying, you know, forget about learning how to sit in a cube for 8 hours a day because that's your purpose in life, to occupy that chair in a cube. Let's actually figure out how to work. Let's actually figure out how to do things that glorify God. Let's take some dominion and let's get out of this system that is sinking fast.
Yeah, this is the Wall Street Journal, Dave. This is the Wall Street Journal. Take your child to work, she says, could become a routine practice rather than a single day annual event. This is the Wall Street Journal. And I would hope that we would have tens of thousands of people coming down to a family economics conference at Wheaton College in Chicago, Illinois, March 8th through 10th of 2012, because I'm here to tell you, the Wall Street Journal gets better readership than I get listenership. I know that the shock to your systems, friends, but we're the ones doing what the Wall Street Journal is recommending for the youth today. If adolescents are going to make it in life by the year 2025, they're going to have to come to the Family Economics Conference, or at least their parents need to show up. And let me encourage you to be at that conference, because that's why we're doing it. We're doing it to salvage our family economies in the year 2020, 2030, 2040. This is the right approach. This is the biblical approach to doing education, mentorship, and economics. So be there, be square. For the sake of your children and your grandchildren, friends, be there at the Family Economics Conference, March 8th through 10th, of 2012. And for more information, hey, check it out right now at FamilyEconomics2012.com. That's FamilyEconomics2012.com. You got to be there. I mean, Dave, this is the best conference ever. I was going over the workshop grid again with Chad. We've got way, way more information, way more panels, way more talks. There's going to be way more expertise there. I mean, we're getting people to understand what this is all about. We're getting to understand what it's all about. And it's kind of exciting. I realize it's the third time around, but personally, I think there ought to be about 300,000 people at this conference, because that's the direction we're trying to take a nation, at least Christians.
You don't have room
and homeschoolers and homeschoolers and those that actually want a direction for the future in terms of their social systems and their economies. Anyway, friends, FamilyEconomics2012.com. If you can't afford the registration fee, just email me at host@kevinswanson.com. We'll try to take care of you. But the key thing is you got to be there. You got to be there.
And bring your children.
Bring the whole family. That's why we have a family rate. And granted, it might be a little bit pricey, but I think we do it for a couple $200 or something for the whole family. It's not that bad for a whole family. And you get 6 or 7, 8, 10 kids there. It's a great opportunity for the whole family. By the way, we're going to have talks for young boys, for young girls, for moms, for dads, how to build that family economy from the inside out, every single aspect of it. It's not just entrepreneurship. It's single income stuff. It's multiple income stuff. It's how to do the marketing. It's how to start the business. It's how to govern your investments and your capital outlay and how to spend your money. And we've got the thrifty couple coming in to talk about how to get your good deals and how to make sure you're expenses are going the right direction. We're talking about debt. We're talking about every single aspect of that family economy, and we're applying biblical principles to it. And there's never been a more important time for this, friends. I mean, you can bet on the fact our present economies are going to come down unless we start building them on biblical principle. And I'm not seeing that in Washington, D.C. And the consumer debt ratio has increased in just the last couple of months. I mean, there was a slight decrease in the early part of 2011, but no, we're way, way up again because people have not changed. They're still the same self-centered existentialists spending their grandkids into debt as they were before the recession. And friends, that's going to bode very, very badly for the next 10, 15 years of this economy. Therefore, let's get back to a biblical approach to economics. And that's what we're trying to do at the Family Economics Conference at Chicago, March 8th through 10th. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can interact with the program by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. Also, if you'd like to make it to the conference and you need that scholarship, just email me at host@kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.